From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program is Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time magazine. She is also the author of the recently published book, Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi, that is, one of the most powerful women in America. She is currently Speaker of the House of Representatives, therefore second in the presidential line of succession after the Vice President. Award-winning journalist Molly Ball chronicles the life of Nancy Pelosi from her birth in Baltimore, Maryland in 1940, the youngest of seven offspring and only female child of Thomas D'Alessandro, a former state and national politician, and wife Annunziata, a native of Naples, Italy. Throughout the book, Molly demonstrates the influence Nancy's Italian heritage and Catholic upbringing had on her character and personality, and how growing up in the rough-and-tumble politics of Baltimore prepared her for her political success. We also learned that it wasn't until Nancy turned 47, after bearing five children in 6 years, did she embark on her unconventional path to political fame. After marrying Paul Pelosi, whom she met in Washington, D.C., while attending a class on African culture and languages at Georgetown's School of Foreign Service, Nancy, her husband, and children eventually moved to San Francisco, California, Paul's home state. There, she became heavily involved in Democratic Party politics, mostly behind the scenes. But in 1986, she was tapped to run for the congressional seat of the dying Sala Burton, who had handpicked Pelosi to replace her. Pelosi's subsequent victory set her on a trajectory to be one of the most formidable politicians, let alone female politicians, in contemporary American history. We'll talk with author Molly Ball, who says that the book project grew out of a profile about Nancy Pelosi she was assigned to write for Time magazine in late 2017, when Pelosi was still House Minority Leader. We will find out that despite the derogatory caricature of Nancy Pelosi by members of the opposition Republican Party, and even challenges to her power by members of her own caucus, steely Nancy Pelosi never gave up and never gave in. She literally epitomized the many aphorisms for which she became famous, such as don't agonize, organize, all in an effort to unify her diverse, often rowdy Democratic caucus and ensure victory at the polls or on legislation. As I read the book, the following adjectives and nouns popped into my head about Pelosi: loyal, survivor, team player, tough, operational, and even stubborn. I'm sure we'll hear some of these words from our special guest, Molly Ball, who will fill us in on the many trials and tribulations that have characterized the rise of Nancy Pelosi. Our listeners may recognize Molly's voice because she is a frequent panelist on our sister program, Issues in the News, a roundup of the week's top stories. And Molly Ball joins us via Microsoft Teams as we continue to social distance. Molly, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you so much for having me and for that wonderful description of my book.
Well, it's a pleasure, and congratulations on the book, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Give us a background in your own words about what prompted you to undertake this research and the type of access you actually had to Speaker Pelosi.
Well, as you mentioned, I was assigned to profile Nancy Pelosi for the cover of Time magazine in late 2017, and she had not been on the cover of Time magazine or any American news magazine before, despite having become the first woman Speaker of the House in American history back in 2007. And she seemed to be a little bit bitter about this. She'd occasionally comment publicly on her frustration at not having been on the cover of Time magazine. And at that time, as you mentioned, she was the leader of the minority party in the House of Representatives, the lower house of Congress, and struggling to return to the position of House Speaker by returning the Democrats to the majority in the 2018 midterms, which did in fact happen. So she was a very important figure in our considerations of the news cycle as the sort of central figure in those midterm elections, the first national elections of the Trump era in American politics that would determine so much of the course of the Donald Trump presidency and the overall climate in Washington. So we met for the first time in a little bakery in Little Italy in Baltimore, where she grew up. And despite the fact that it was freezing cold outside because it was January in Baltimore, the middle of winter, she ordered chocolate ice cream for breakfast. And we proceeded to have a conversation about her life and her roots, one of many conversations that I would have with her. And as I researched her life and her career, I realized that she's one of these people everybody seems to have an opinion about, particularly in America, where she's a very polarizing figure, but very few people seem to really know the story of. And it is a fascinating story, from her roots as the daughter of a political family to her move to the West Coast, her activism in Democratic politics, and her rise through the ranks of the American legislature to becoming the first woman speaker, something that no woman had ever done before. When she entered the United States Congress in 1987, she was one of 23 women members of the House of Representatives out of 435 members. So it's a story about women's representation in American politics as much as anything else. After I wrote that profile on the cover of Time magazine that appeared in September 2018, and once the Democrats won those 2018 midterm elections, once Nancy Pelosi became Speaker of the House again, there was a major reversal in her public image. A lot of people who had previously denigrated her said that she was too old and not to retire or make room for a new generation. Suddenly, those people seem to have flipped right around and realized that she's very good at her job of legislating, negotiating with the other party and with her own party, keeping the Congress running, keeping her party together in order to make policy. And she's been intimately involved this year in the trillions of dollars in coronavirus relief legislation that the Congress has been passing. So I felt that there was a bigger story here to be told, that she was worth a book-length treatment. It is my first book. She's the first politician I've profiled who I thought deserved to be written about at this length. And so I wrote the book.
Molly Ball, let's talk about her upbringing in Baltimore very briefly. As you said, the daughter of a prominent local politician. How did this upbringing and her Italian heritage, her Catholic faith, how did that shape her, this young, prim and proper girl who couldn't actually even escape her own mother's predicament? Her mother, I think, wanted, as you described, to attend law school, to be more than just a housewife. And Nancy Pelosi, well, of course, she more than succeeded in life. Early on, she also gave up going to law school. She got married, even though she did have an excellent education at Trinity College. She had child after child. How did this upbringing shape her and prepare her for the role in the national limelight?
You're right to start by focusing on her Italian heritage and Catholic faith. Those are very central to her identity and were a huge part of her upbringing as a child. Now, she was raised in a political family, but being the only girl at a time when women were almost non-existent as elected officials, she was never sort of trained to be a politician like her father. Her brothers were, but she was never expected to go into the family business as she eventually would end up doing. But politics was very much in her blood. As you mentioned, her mother, who was an Italian immigrant, had a lot of frustrated ambitions. She wanted to be an auctioneer. She wanted to go to law school. She wanted to have a career in business, but her husband would not allow her to do that. And so as Nancy Pelosi was growing up and seeing her mother limited in all of those ways, it made her really determined to be in control of her own life and to have a career of her own. So she did then become a housewife. She had 5 children in 6 years and was a very devoted and strict mother to those children, as her children will still attest today now that they're grown. But she was always active in politics, and it was Democratic Party politics specifically. She wasn't an issue activist who was, you know, out at protests in the mold of a lot of other children of the 1960s and 70s. It was, she would be pushing a stroller around her neighborhood in New York City at the time and putting leaflets for the Democratic Party under the doors of people's apartments. And then when they moved to California, it was again through the Democratic Party that she was active in politics, working to raise money for Democratic candidates, chairing the California Democratic Party, the largest Democratic Party at the state level in the country, having senior positions in the National Democratic Party, all before she ever took an official position by running for office. So the type of politics that she would have learned in Baltimore would have been the sort of classic American urban machine politics that you hear about, right? Where these sort of tribes and factions of the urban environment all have these sort of political bosses who can corral their votes and deliver them to a politician in exchange for favors. So that type of campaigning and organizing and trading favors very much informs her style. But also, she is always called by the opposition, by the Republicans, a quote-unquote San Francisco liberal, by which they mean everything that's associated with California in American politics. So environmentalism and being anti-war and being liberal on social issues, particularly the issue of gay rights. She came into office at the height of the AIDS epidemic, which San Francisco was the epicenter of. So she was always on the forefront of that issue. So I think in the persona of Nancy Pelosi, you really see the evolution of the American Democratic Party from the party it was in the early 20th century, which was very much about these sort of white ethnic urban democratic machines, to the Democratic Party today, which is very much more a party of the coasts, a party of social liberalism, a party of, you might say, San Francisco values.
Well, that's an interesting conclusion. Not only that she, in a sense, or her story is the story of the rise of women in U.S. politics, but also the evolution of the Democratic Party. And based on her career, she is really not the caricature that many Republicans have painted her. In fact, you argue in the book that she is quite a master negotiator, and she has negotiated very skillfully with Republican presidents, not just President Trump, but George W. Bush before him. So how do you square that?
Well, Nancy Pelosi's ultimate goal is always to get things done. And she is relentless in her pursuit of that. You mentioned one of the adjectives that plays a big role in the book, operational. And this was a word that one of her mentors used to describe her, meaning she is always focused on finding a way to get things done. It's not about making herself look good or feel good or making somebody impressed with her. It's about getting things done, changing policies in a way that, in her view, improves the lives of the American people and people of the world, she would certainly argue. So when she first became Speaker of the House, George W. Bush was the president, and she did work with him to get things done. And she stood up to the extremes in her own party when they preferred to stand on principle rather than get things done. She refused to shut down the government, to try to revoke funding from the war in Iraq, which a lot of liberals wanted to do at the time. She refused to impeach George W. Bush, which a lot of liberals also wanted to do at the time. So she's always seen herself as trying to steer that liberal but pragmatic middle course. And I think you see the results of that in that she is almost as detested by the far left of the Democratic Party today as she is by the Republicans, who depict her as completely far left. So she has been in these negotiations with President Trump or with other members of the Trump administration. And she's a very tough negotiator. In fact, part of the reason that the Republicans refused to negotiate with her today in this ongoing standoff over more COVID relief is they feel that she's done too well in the past several rounds of negotiations, that the Democrats have gotten too much of what they wanted because of her negotiating skill. But she has never been the type of politician that you do see in parts of the Congress who says, if I don't get my way, I'm just going to take my ball and go home. Nothing is going to happen unless you give me everything that I want. So in contrast to some other politicians of the era, there has not been a government shutdown on Nancy Pelosi's watch. In fact, she came into the speakership in 2019 during a government shutdown that had begun when she was not speaker, and she was instrumental in finding the end of that government shutdown. So she does believe in compromise. She also believes in standing on principle, but she is not going to allow the system to shut down when things don't go her way.
She certainly is a pragmatist at the end of the day and defies labels. We'll be back in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our special guest is Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time magazine and author of the recently published book, Pelosi. And Molly joins us via Microsoft Teams as we continue to practice social distancing. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Ronix Abuya from Nairobi, Kenya. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our program, back to Molly Ball, author of Pelosi. Molly, I want to continue talking about Pelosi's extraordinary career and some of the signature issues that she did champion early on, even though you said that she is really a master legislator and she's not really characterized by her issues per se. But I was very impressed by the fact that she did champion help for the AIDS epidemic and also Tiananmen Square. She managed to get visa extensions for Chinese studying in the United States who could have been targeted had they gone home. So talk about why these were very important to her career.
So as I mentioned, she arrived in Congress during the height of the AIDS epidemic and was coming from a district in San Francisco, which was being hit very hard by the epidemic. So she worked very hard on AIDS-related legislation in her early years in Congress. And the most high-profile result of that was the Ryan White Act, which devoted millions of dollars in federal funding for health care for AIDS patients. But human rights in China was the issue that really sort of put her on the national stage and made her recognized by more than just people in California. She saw what happened in Tiananmen Square in 1989, and it just lighted a sort of fire of moral outrage within her. She wanted to do something about it, and this issue of student visas was what she sort of fixed on as one small way that she felt she could make a difference for the potential victims of the Chinese regime. But she also worked very hard to condition Chinese trade on progress in human rights. And there was a lasting rift between her and President Bill Clinton when he broke his promise to her to impose that restriction on trade with China, and in fact opened up a lot of trade with China without such restrictions. In 1991, Nancy Pelosi and a couple of other members of Congress actually traveled to China and then defied the Chinese government and created an international incident by staging a protest in Tiananmen Square, captured on camera by journalists who were there and chased out of the square by the Chinese police. So that was a very aggressive thing for her to do, and the Chinese regime was not fond of her as a result. But she has continued to devote herself to this issue up to the present day, and really international human rights are a major passion of hers for which she has continued to advocate.
Talk also about her role on the Intelligence Committee. How did she get interested in that, and to what extent does that really bolster her foreign policy and national security bona fides?
The Intelligence Committee is one of the most prestigious in the Congress. It deals with sensitive and highly classified information, state secrets, national security. And despite the fact that women in politics are most often identified with sort of soft or family-oriented issues like healthcare and education and childcare and so on, Nancy Pelosi has always gravitated to what I think of as the hard committees, the sort of more male-dominated realms like war and peace, like taxing and spending. So the Intelligence Committee is also something that you have to be picked for. So you have to be impressive enough to the senior leadership of your party that they want to put you on this very serious and very important committee. They have to feel that you're equipped for it and capable. So she was the top Democrat on the Intelligence Committee in 2001 when the September 11th attacks occurred, and the intelligence committees in the House and Senate at that time were privy to a lot of the secret intelligence on which the George Bush administration was basing its case for the war in Iraq. So it was partly because she had seen that evidence and felt that it was not sufficient that Nancy Pelosi was one of the most prominent opponents of the war in Iraq. A lot of senior Democrats, as well as Republicans, supported giving George W. Bush permission to wage war in Iraq in 2002. But Nancy Pelosi strongly disagreed. So despite the fact that Nancy Pelosi was not the Speaker of the House at that time, she was not even the leader of the Democrats at that time, although she was in a leadership position, she tried to get as many of her colleagues as possible to vote against the war. And she succeeded, actually. About 60% of the Democrats in the House voted against the war, unlike the Senate, where most Democrats and Republicans supported it. And that is one of the instances in her career when she has really been true to her beliefs, even when it did not seem politically convenient in the moment. And a lot of Democrats worried that if they took this anti-war position, they would be seen as soft on terrorism. But she had the courage of her convictions. And I think most Americans now would look back and say that she was on the right side of that.
And then she went on to become Speaker of the House, correct, in 2006.
That's right. In 2006, the Democrats won the midterm elections, and Nancy Pelosi had been the minority leader up to that time. And so in 2007, she was officially inaugurated as the first woman Speaker of the House. President Bush made a very nice speech about how, despite their, you know, different political parties, he was tremendously proud to be presiding over this circumstance of a woman finally achieving this very high office. And when she picked up the gavel, she was surrounded by her 9 grandchildren. They all came up with her to rejoice and to hug her. So it's a very striking image when you see, if you were to look at the sweep of American history, see all of the people who have been speakers of the House, it would be a whole bunch of men up until that point. And then you have the image of this quite feminine woman surrounded by her grandchildren picking up that gavel. She talks a lot in conversation and in her memoir what it feels like to be the only woman in the room. And ever since she became the leader of the Democrats in the House, whenever the president gathers the top leaders of the two parties in the House and the Senate, and they meet at the White House to have a negotiation or some other type of meeting, she's not only the only woman in that room, she's the only woman who's ever been in that room to this day, the only woman ever to lead a party in the American Congress. So she has said that she sort of feels the weight of history on her shoulders in those moments. And she has also said that had Hillary Clinton won the 2016 election, she might have retired because she would have been satisfied that there was still a woman in that room. She says that part of the reason she stayed on and has been such a thorn in the side of President Trump is because there would not have been a woman in the room had she not stayed on.
She's not only a thorn in the side of President Trump, she faced quite a bit of opposition among her own caucus. Even for this speakership, there were a number of other members, mostly male, from some of the battleground states. I remember Tim Ryan from Ohio. He's only in his 40s. Talk about where things stand right now. She seems to have really galvanized people behind her, even those who originally opposed her. What's the state of play right now? And what's going to happen? I guess it all depends on the elections in 2020, but is she grooming others, someone to succeed her?
Well, so the first time Nancy Pelosi became Speaker of the House in 2007, she was unopposed because she had been the Democratic leader in the minority. But then the Democrats lost the midterm elections in 2010 after President Obama became president in 2008. And for several years, they were in the minority. And because Nancy Pelosi is quite an unpopular national figure, the Republicans have used her image in hundreds of millions of dollars of political attack ads all over the country, very far from any place that anybody could actually vote for Nancy Pelosi, since she only represents her little district in San Francisco. But the Republicans have used the image of her to remind voters of who is in charge of the Democratic Party if it gets control of the House of Representatives, and to accuse her of being a sort of scary San Francisco liberal, as they term it. And she believes, actually, that this is a coded appeal against gay rights. Be that as it may, having become such an unpopular figure, the subject of so many attacks, she began to be perceived as a drag on her own party. So the irony here is that, you know, the day after Donald Trump was elected president, there was an uprising of women in America that is unlike anything we've seen in this nation's history. Women were absolutely galvanized by what happened in 2016. They began forming political organizations. They became activists. They started voting in much larger proportions and running for office in numbers that have never been seen before. So these two trends climaxed at the same time. So she did have to fight to retain the speakership in 2019. She ultimately won that fight, but the argument that her detractors made was, this person has been in charge of the Democratic caucus for 15 years. That's too long. She needs to move on. She needs to retire, make room for a new generation, make room for a figure to represent the Democrats in the national discourse who's more electorally palatable in a lot of the more conservative districts of the country. But a lot of those detractors have changed their tune nowadays, in part because she has been so effective as speaker in dealing with Trump and the Republicans, but also in dealing with her own party and keeping the far left in line with the more mainstream and moderate Democrats. The same moderate members who tried to get rid of her are now grateful that she's there as sort of a moderating force. She did not impeach President Trump until nearly a year into her speakership. When the impeachment did happen, she managed it in such a way that it would be limited in scope and brief in duration. And the moderates in the Democratic Party appreciate that very much, that she has not let the more liberal wing of the party have its way. So Nancy Pelosi never talks about whether and how she might retire. She did, as part of her negotiations to regain the speakership in 2019, agree to a self-imposed term limit that says she would have to step down no later than 2022. So if she wins her current election this year, that would give her one more term. And she has not really groomed a successor. Her deputies in leadership are more rivals and contemporaries. In fact, they're all about her age. They are not junior members that she's been bringing up the ladder. And when she first ran for a position in the leadership structure of the Congress, she was not the sort of next in line chosen candidate. She had to challenge the male-dominated establishment power structure in order to get a position of leadership. So she very much believes, as a core part of her philosophy, that power is not something that is given to you. Power is something you have to take. And so she believes if somebody wants to succeed her, that person has to fight for it. But there is among the House Democrats quite a lot of behind-the-scenes jockeying and people currying favor with their colleagues, so that in the event that Nancy Pelosi does decide to retire, there are a lot of Democrats who would be looking to take her place.
Indeed. And we can talk about that another day. But as we close, Molly Ball, I would like you to speculate on what you think Nancy Pelosi would like to see her legacy as.
I've actually asked her this question directly, and she is very clear on the answer. She wants her legacy to be the Affordable Care Act, the first legislation and only legislation in American history to guarantee access to health care for every American. She worked with President Barack Obama to achieve this. I argue in the book that it probably would not have gotten done were it not for her efforts. And in fact, she convinced President Obama at the time not to give up and to keep trying when it appeared to be impossible. I would add a couple of things. I think being the first woman speaker in American history is a huge accomplishment that will undoubtedly be how she is remembered in history, something that no woman in American history ever did before she did it. And not only did she achieve that position, but she really, I think, became a role model to a lot of other women interested in political power, sending a signal to little girls that they can aspire to that kind of high office and that they don't have to compromise who they are in order to get there. She has left a sort of unique stamp on the speakership, and she's really different than a lot of other women politicians in the way she presents herself, bringing the grandchildren up and so on, the way she comports herself as a politician. And then lastly, I think a big part of her legacy has to be her effectiveness as a legislator. I'm not a historian or political scientist, but the historians and political scientists I have consulted say that by various metrics, she is one of the most effective speakers in the history of the American legislature. You have to go back to the likes of Sam Rayburn or Lyndon Johnson for that kind of effectiveness at corralling all of the different various factions and putting the votes together to pass major legislation. And she's done it at a time of historic polarization and gridlock, at a time when a lot of Americans have become cynical that the Congress doesn't work at all and isn't capable of doing anything. She has repeatedly proven that she is still able to get things done despite this polarized and gridlocked climate that we live in. So I think that is also a huge part of her legacy.
The book is Pelosi, the author, Time Magazine political correspondent Molly Ball. Molly, once again, congratulations on the book. And thanks so much for your time and insights on one of the most prominent women in U.S. politics today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.